This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElraith. We're standing here in the car park, frankly, getting blown to kingdom come.
Yeah, we're just looking at the beech trees bending over, looking up at the sky and the clouds are just scurrying over it. We've got winds up to 70 miles an hour here today. It is pretty dramatic.
Yeah, anything that is likely to blow me over has to be reasonably strong, it has to be said. As we enter a new year, you might be thinking about how you can go about reducing your carbon footprint in 2020. Or, like a lot of people, you might be thinking, well, what difference is anything I'm going to do actually going to make?
Yeah, we've been looking into this issue for the past few months, and in the run-up to the UN Climate Change Conference, which is going to take place in Glasgow later this year, we'll continue to examine all the issues surrounding it for the people living in Scotland.
Now, one man who's been heavily involved in influencing change when it comes to environmental matters over the past 20 years is a bloke called Mike Robinson. Mike is the chief executive of the Royal Scottish Geographical Society, but he also founded a coalition group, Stop Climate Chaos, about 1991. It was a while ago. I caught up with him this week in an equally windy Perth, where he outlined the main challenges and, as he sees it, opportunities ahead.
We're going to take a long, hard look at our reliance on fossil fuels, of course, and our reliance on the North Sea and what the future of the North Sea is. We need to find funding to help the next stage of transition. Every report I've ever seen talks about, I mean, the Stern Report 2006, the Net Zero Report of last year, talked about the need to spend around 2% of GDP to help make the changes now. If we don't, we risk spending 20% of GDP addressing the problems later. So it absolutely makes economic sense to move this forward, but we do need to find some of that money now and start making that happen.
Spend 2% on what?
On all sorts of things. There's a transition required in transport. It's very difficult to join up transport. You find that the sector itself doesn't join up very well. So the cycling and active travel community don't necessarily engage with the rail community, don't engage with the roads community, don't engage with aviation. So none of these sectors are talking as much as they could or should. And therefore, we don't have a very integrated transport scheme. We over-rely on the car. One of the statistics that I was told recently was that we're expecting 30% more road traffic over the next 10 to 15 years. And the mood in the room was that therefore we needed more roads. Whereas I think driving is already pretty awful in some parts. It's well congested in many, many parts of Scotland. Another third again of traffic. God, surely that's a signal to do things differently, do things better, and find more creative ways to get people moving around.
You spoke earlier about reliance on fossil fuels. It's interesting, I would struggle, to be honest, to get anybody to actually say this in front of a microphone, but I know many people who work in the oil and gas industry because I live in Aberdeenshire. Many of them say to me, anecdotally, off the record, that they are having conversations amongst the big companies saying, it's not that they're on a hiding to nothing, but they know that the clock is ticking, that there's probably more oil and gas out there than ultimately politically they're going to be allowed to extract.
Well, there's more oil and gas out there than scientifically they should extract, or unless we find a really clever mechanism for reducing CO2 in the atmosphere, and we haven't found that yet. So, yeah, the clock is ticking, absolutely. But I think it is really important, though, that nobody wants the society to fall over. We all want it to be successful. We all want to live in a place where people are employed and people have things to do and people have food to eat and warm houses to live in and all the rest of it. We all want that. Actually, the only issue is that we can't do it the way we've been doing it for the last 50 years. I actually think that on one level, whilst that's undoubtedly challenging, it's also quite exciting too, because in a way we've got to reimagine lots of different parts of the way that we live. And you can see that as a threat and a change, but actually some of it is probably quite positive. Some of it's actually got knock-on benefits. It's got win-wins. I mean, we need to do more getting outdoors. We need to do more exercise. So maybe driving to the, you know, the shop front door is not the answer going forwards. You know, we need more creative solutions.
Are you conscious of the fact that many folk want to be able to do something, want to be able to make changes, but frankly aren't just terribly certain how to go about doing it?
I think that's a really important issue. A lot of people aren't sure of the best thing to do. And when they are told what is a good thing to do, someone else will tell them why it isn't. So
yeah, there's a lot of that goes on.
Aye. So it's a really important point that we actually are clear about what we are going to do and what will make a difference, what will work. The Scottish Government have got a very good climate change delivery plan, which lays out in quite a lot of detail what we want people to do, but nobody's read it. So we have to help people understand what's in there. We need to get behind the things that are going to make the really big differences and help people understand the role they can play. We can't just sit and wait for government to do this. They've already done a lot of what they can do. They can do more, everybody can do more, but they can't do it on their own. And so they need businesses and public bodies and NGOs and individuals to help.
It's actually quite difficult sometimes being Caesar's wife. We try and communicate these ideas. We're not trying to push forward an agenda in the programme in any way, shape or form, but we understand this is important and we are genuinely looking for answers to questions that are out there. But by the same token, I'm racking up 25,000, 30,000 miles a year professionally. I don't fly very often, but you know, there's a limit to what you can do. And to a certain extent, that inhibits me from probably being more vocal than perhaps I should be.
Well, there's an interesting point there straight away. First of all, that fear of hypocrisy holds lots of people back. And actually, that itself is not helpful. I mean, I've been involved in this arena for 20, 25 years. I've made lots of changes to my lifestyle.
But such as?
I've done everything I can to insulate, draft-proof the house. I've got an electric car. I cycle or run or bus to work. I don't fly. I haven't flown.
Don't fly, full stop.
I do the very occasional overseas trip when I have to, but basically I haven't flown in the UK for 20 years. There's no need. So I get trains for that type of journey. And I've taken trains to the continent and stuff as well. There's lots and lots of things that are out there that you can do. So I've made loads of changes. But the point is, I could still do more. And I think the truth is that everybody could do more. It doesn't matter how much you've done. You can always do more. That isn't a reason not to do those things. It's actually a reason to stop holding yourself back. None of us are perfect. As long as you're alive, you're probably making an impact somewhere. And I think we just have to slightly get over that and focus on the things that we can do and make the changes we can, recognising that it's a journey. You're always taking another step, another step, another step. There's always something else that you can do.
Is there anything specifically you're doing at the moment that would help in terms of individuals?
We have been creating a qualification, an online qualification aimed largely at people who are working. We're developing it with the University of Edinburgh, University of Stirling and the Institute of Directors. It's a climate solutions qualification available online, and it's there to try to help people understand the issue and, most importantly of all, understand the solutions. It's critical that we're all helping deliver the solutions and we're all pulling in the same direction. So that's what it's really aimed at, is shortcutting 20, 30 years of learning into a few hours online, and hopefully then you're in a far better position to understand how you, your organisation, your community can play a role.
And yet, change is uncomfortable.
Change is uncomfortable, and if there's one thing I think I would appeal for people to do, it's to allow change. It's not, yes, in many cases make those changes that you can. It's not always possible to make every change, but at the moment we still have some choice around that. But the most important thing we can all do is actually allow some of that change. We know why this is needed. We can see that every day. So sometimes the best thing we can possibly do is allow it to happen.
Mike Robinson, Chief Executive of the Royal Scottish Geographical Society there.
Controversial.
Slightly, but by the same token, you know, what were we discussing? This business of folk, you know, we've done it, thinking, well, okay, yeah, we can do X, we can do Y, but, you know, really, are we making any impact at all? And then there's a tendency to think, well, if it's making no impact, why should I bother in the first place?
Or you can lead by example.
Yeah, you can try. Well, we all know trees have an important role to play in tackling climate change. There's a real drive to plant more across the UK, and a real drive to plant more across the UK. But to fully benefit from the good that trees can do, we need to understand a variety of things. How our changing weather is impacting woods and forests now, how it might impact them in the future, and what the best trees are for the best location. The University of Stirling is leading a Europe-wide study called the Foresight Project, and I met up with a Professor Al Jump, great name, from the Faculty of Natural Sciences, who's leading the project.
So the idea behind the research is really to give us a much better understanding of how forests will respond to conditions in the future, and how we actually go about both monitoring and indeed predicting that change. And of course, we need to turn this into something usable if we're to manage forests, if we're to plan, to actually be able to deliver tools that are useful to folks who are involved in our forest management.
The main tree you're looking at here is beech. Is that not a wee bit controversial in Scotland?
In Scotland, it is certainly controversial. I mean, for the continent as a whole, it is perhaps the most widespread broadleaf tree that we have. It's also one that is of very high importance for our forest industries across the continent. Of course, in Scotland, there is controversy because it was a slow starter in the UK. It took quite a long time to get going after the retreat of the last glaciers. And it didn't get to Scotland, certainly until man shifted it about, but it would have got here anyway. It's basically a case of how long rather than whether it would have got here or not.
That's actually quite a good point. We operate, I mean, humans and trees operate on essentially different timescales. If there is a sense of is there a sense of urgency to this? Can there be a sense of urgency to this?
Absolutely. I think there really is a sense of urgency. We may well operate in different timescales in terms of our lifespans, the way we function as individuals. But if we're looking at a managed landscape, which is one that we absolutely have in Scotland, we need to be planning for our landscapes of the future. And that means working out what we plant now, where we plant it, and how it will fare under the different climates that we face.
If the climate is changing things, what stresses particularly are you looking at?
Well, in beech, and this will sound ironic as far as Scotland's concerned as well, in beech we're actually focusing very strongly on drought impacts on this species, because it is extremely susceptible to drought, and we've started to see, well, across the globe with a variety of species, major mortality and die-off events in forests. Beech, knowing that it's sensitive to drought, we're looking to understand where those drought impacts are likely to be most severe. And certainly in the south of the UK, that is forecast to be a real problem. But it's more really than just thinking of gradual changes in climate. The sorts of extreme events that we're now beginning to witness much more frequently will also have a really big effect, whether it be drought or whether it be inundations such as those that we've experienced in the UK very significantly over this last year. Because beech doesn't like its feet wet as well as not liking drought.
We do get drought. I mean, most recently, I'm thinking 2 or 3 years ago, there was a really, really hot summer. But I mean, I'm old enough to remember 1976.
Yes.
A lot of stuff died in 1976.
Absolutely. I mean, I was three at that stage, so my memory of 1976 is not so great. But what we saw with the 1976 drought was that it led to a real shift in the competition between species in our forests. So, for example, down in the south of England, beech was really hammered, but the oaks actually benefited because they were better able to deal with the drought than the beech was when they were in mixed forests. So, I mean, it's a real indication, basically, that as those sorts of events become more frequent, they will lead to very significant shifts in our forest composition. And that's the same in Scotland as it is elsewhere in the UK.
What's your methodology here? How are you doing this research?
So we have a mixture of different methodologies. So some of the work that we are doing is basically using tree ring research. So we can understand when we have narrow rings, when we have wide rings, what that means for the tree's growth, and whether those narrow rings or wide rings respond to, for example, a dry year and a wet year respectively. So we can understand how the climate has influenced tree growth over its lifetime. And then we use that to model how the tree growth is likely to change in the future as the climate changes. So we can then build models to predict changes in tree growth. But of course, we need to be able to monitor that. And for that, we're using satellite data. We're using remote sensing data. The idea being that we can make predictions, we can then build the tools to monitor them, and we can make those tools available to anyone that needs to use them, basically.
Coming up with a tool that will allow you to predict things is one thing. Coming up with an action plan is a different thing altogether. Can you do that?
Yes, you certainly can. So one of the outcomes of the project that has been built into the planning from the start is that we have Forest Research as a partner in the project. And one of the things that we're doing there is actually developing a tool that can then advise landowners, land managers, on the utility of this species going forward. Of course, this is just one species, but we're developing the tools in Beech that we will then be able to expand to a suite of other species.
And you are working in cooperation here with other universities, other institutions around Europe?
Yes. So in the UK, we work with Durham University, with the geography department there. And we also work with the Technical University of Munich and the Technical University of Dresden as well, where there's specific expertise on looking at risk mapping in this species, but also some very good folk on the modelling side.
How important is it to have this information?
It is vitally important. I come back to the point of us being a managed landscape. We have to act proactively. We cannot just simply wait and then try and mop up the very serious mess that we're in. I mean, trees are one part of our adaptation strategy, and if we don't focus on the actions that we need to make now in order to offset some of the major difficulties we will experience in the future, then we really are in a much greater mess than we otherwise should be in.
Professor Al Jump there from the University of Stirling.
Now, possibly the first ever mention of Canadian pop favourite Justin Bieber on Scotland Outdoors. Why, you ask? Well, earlier this week, he revealed that he's been suffering from Lyme's disease, a topic we've discussed on this programme many times before.
There are around, they reckon, 200 recorded incidents of Lyme disease in Scotland each year, but the actual number of cases is thought to be very much higher. The trouble is, very often people don't realise they've got it, and sometimes if they do go to the doctor says, oh, you've got a viral infection, and, you know, they don't actually identify exactly what it is. If it's not caught in time, it can have devastating effects on health. Now, the standard treatment for the tick-borne disease is antibiotics, but, as herbalist Monica Wells has been discovering, plants could offer some relief for certain sufferers. All sorts of plants, including the dreaded Japanese knotweed.
This last year, I've been specialising just in people who've got Lyme disease. That's a disease that's carried by ticks.
Yeah.
And very often, it's not just a question of one bacteria, the Borrelia burgdorferi, which is the name Lyme really means, but there's lots of other infections as well. So ticks tend to carry multiple infections. And we actually only test for one in the UK. So a lot of the tests are not necessarily conclusive. And also, they're not called stealth infections for nothing. They tend to hide from the immune system. They burrow into tissues, into connective tissue. So they're quite good at evading both tests, you know, and the immune system as well. So sometimes if people get bitten straight away, they might notice. A, they might notice because they pulled a tick off them. And then they'll get a rash around it, like a bullseye rash that sort of spreads. But not everybody gets that. I think only somewhere like 60 to 70% of cases have the rash. You know, a lot of people don't have a rash, or they don't notice they were bitten by a tick, or they don't get any symptoms straight away. And it may be, you know, a few days later or a few weeks later, in some cases a few days later, where they have some sort of immune challenge, that they start to get terrible aches and pains, things that feel like heart attacks, but when they're checked out, there's nothing wrong with their heart, you know, palpitations and sudden bursts of tachycardia. There's a lot of neurological conditions like brain fog, chronic fatigue. And sometimes people go for years and years and years with nobody ever coming to a diagnosis or being told that they have atypical rheumatoid arthritis. Because testing's poor, because the diagnosis is poor, a lot of people fall out of the health system. You know, their GPs can't do anything for them, don't really know what to do with them, kind of, you know, dread them coming back in with yet more complaints of what's wrong with them.
So how do you test them? Or do you test them?
I don't test them. People can do private tests. Most of them are in Germany. There's a couple of labs in Germany that do testing. You know, their blood can be drawn here and then sent off by courier to Germany. Some people send their blood to America to be tested. And that looks for a couple of different things. You know, one, it looks for the actual antibodies. Have you made antibodies to Borrelia, Babesia, Bartonella, Anaplasma, and so on? And also, what's the status of your immune system? So if you've got the CD57 cells really low, it's showing that your immune system is trying to deal with something like a chronic infection. There are different immunological markers. So if you've been bitten by a tick and you've, you know, got all the sort of clinical symptoms and, you know, your blood is showing that your immune system is severely challenged, well, there's a very good chance that it was that. If you then add an antigen into them, if you've been showing that, you know, if your body shows antibodies because you were bitten at some stage by a tick, then that may well be what you're treating.
So what do you treat them with?
I just use herbs, but I work alongside some doctors who use antibiotics. But antibiotics in longer treatment cycles than is normally recommended because, you know, these bacteria are in some cases antibiotic resistant.
How much longer?
Some doctors will give people combined antibiotics for 3 months. Some will treat up to a year.
Wow.
All right.
That's considerably longer.
That's considerably longer. And obviously that has its challenges to the body as well. Yeah. But where herbs come into it is that they support the body's systems as well as having an antimicrobial activity. So there are plants where, for instance, Japanese knotweed, everybody complains about it around here. You know, it's one of the main herbs in the treatment of Lyme disease. But there are others as well, like Cryptolepis, which is Ghanaian quinine, where you can literally, you know, grow the Borrelia, you know, in a Petri dish, you know, put in the herb or an essential oil that you're testing, and then you can see how many of the bacteria get killed or inhibited. So we know that there's quite a range of herbs and essential oils that will actually kill those bacteria. So on one hand, we're able to do, you know, gentler antimicrobial work, and some of those alongside antibiotics, because I record all the medications and the herbs so that we know from a safety point of view what's happening. Some of them, like, for instance, Sweet Annie, Artemisia, which is very similar to the mugwort that's growing around here, actually helps to potentiate the drug. So it helps the antibiotics to get into the cells where it would otherwise have difficulty penetrating so deeply. But then the other side of it is also then to support the person's immune system, to relieve pain, to help to protect the joints, you know, to help them rebuild collagen, to calm down the nerves, which tend to get overstimulated and cause buzzing and other problems, the headaches, you know, to make them more comfortable and to increase their resistance, to increase their white blood cell count. You know, plants can do all of this as well. And, you know, they've been very, very well studied.
Herbalist Monica Wilde there. So she's not saying you can treat it purely with plants. This is to augment the treatment with antibiotics or to ameliorate the effects of the antibiotics.
Yeah, if you're on antibiotics, stick with it.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Now, the end of last year, in December, you were one of the hosts of the RSPB Nature of Scotland.
Yeah, it's a great night. And what's really good about it is because it rewards people who've worked tirelessly to help nature and wildlife. And this year's winner of the Species Champion Award was Stuart Taylor. And he's dedicated his life to conserving wildlife in the Cairn Gorges National Park. And he's been focusing on one of our most important trees, the aspen.
Well, we're up in Tulloch, 9 or 10 miles from Aviemore. And we've come into an area that is one of Scotland's best aspen woods. And this wood was identified by a chap who did a PhD in here as being important because as he walked around, he realised that many of these trees were a little bit unusual. And the more time he spent in here, he actually watched for the trees coming into leaf every year. And by doing that, he realised that within this wood, we have something like 20-odd different clones. Now, that's quite a difficult thing to get your head around because a lot of these aspens have been here for probably thousands of years.
So some of these trees could be, what, 6,000-7,000 years old?
The trees themselves here, we don't get them much more than 100, 120 years. But because you can see around us now, you can see the young trees trying to pop up from the roots of these aspen under the ground. They've probably managed to keep themselves growing, providing they're not grazed too heavily. You get the new trees coming through, so that tree, this will be one of its offspring just coming from its roots. And because of that, they've been able to grow for quite a long time without having to worry too much about new trees coming in.
And it looks like some of them were having a hard time. No matter which way I look, there are fallen, rotten trees.
Yeah, well, I think this was brought home quite strongly to me. In about 2007, 2008, the Highland Aspen Group and John Parrott put together a proposal to fly the whole of Strathspey and actually photograph from the air where the aspens were. And it was only by coming around to do some ground truthing afterwards to see is that an aspen group or not that I started to think every wood I went into there were trees lying on the ground. This is almost a wood. Many of our aspen stands are half a dozen trees, and you're starting to realise you're seeing trees that are falling over and there's nothing coming through to replace them. I don't like fencing, but what we're now starting to see, this owner has allowed these fences to go in, and we're actually seeing massive amounts of regeneration coming up. This hollow is just full of young aspens waiting to get a chance to grow. Last year, for the first time since 1996, the aspens actually flowered, and we now know that in 1995 we had a very hot summer, and in 2018 we had a very hot summer, and these aspens responded to that. Whether they panic because they think we're going to die, we don't have the water and it produces flowers, I don't know, but there was enough growth, enough pollen floating around last year that there must be cross-fertilisation. A lot of seed was collected in here to put into tree nurseries.
They are incredibly important, for not just for the trees themselves, incredibly important for wildlife.
We're heading quite nicely to a tree that is very important here. If we go back to the year 2000, it was about then that the people who are lichenologists started to realise that these trees are supporting unusual species.
It's about the size of an orange, squashed orange. It's got circle of grey and then almost dark crimson bits in the middle. It's a weird looking thing.
These two are lichens that you'd normally find further west, where we get a damper climate, the trees are more receptive. But what we have with an aspen, the bark is actually fairly rich and it's supporting these Degelia lichens.
You've got loads of different types. And these,
yes, you've got these
fluffy green
fluffy
ones.
Green ones, yes.
So they will survive then. We can see the fence up there.
I mean, just look at the wood here waiting to grow. Every metre here has a young aspen.
It's just a sea of tiny wee aspens ready to go.
These are called suckers, so these are coming up off all the roots. The bark on this tree might be so important that we need the trees near to it to grow so that this rare lichen can actually grow on them. You're looking a little bit closer to try to get the clones going that are supporting the important stuff at the moment. These lichens only come on as the tree matures. This is the fence. This was put in 2 years ago, and already you're starting to see the suckers that we saw back there that are only 6-7 inches high. They're starting to now grow, and you can see them, they're a foot, 2 foot high already in that.
Wait a minute, I can't see them.
So you've got, when the leaves are out, and it would be much more obvious. I mean, the other thing we have to think of, the rare dark-bordered beauty moth requires suckers that sort of height. So when they get into trees, you've lost the habitat that this rare moth demands.
This is complicated stuff.
So one of the ideas in some of these areas might be to get these growing, electric fence for a period of time, a bit of it off, let the sheep come in, nibble these back, because that's how these suckers are kept in the ideal condition for the dark-bordered beauty moth. And what you can do then is move the fence, let these grow, get your next set of trees, and perhaps have another bit that is grazed, you know.
And there's lots of other things depend on aspen.
We've got the aspen hopperfly, and it only breeds on aspen trees of a reasonable size, so mature trees like these, and the tree is only suitable for them to breed for something like 3 or 4 years after falling down.
Do we need aspen, though? I mean, has it not just come to the evolutionary dead end?
Well, when you think these might be trees that have been growing here from trees from several thousand years ago, perhaps, you know, you think, well, it is on its way out. But, you know, we saw last year when the conditions were right, it had the dry summer, these trees came to life, they produced all the seed.
You must spend a lot of time looking at trees.
Well, once I'd done this help with the mapping and realising the problems that we were facing here, it was only going out with Brian Coppins and Sandy Coppins at Inch that I realised that we have these unusual lichens. So from 2010 to the present time, I've been through nearly all our major aspen stands from Newton Moor right through to beyond Grantown. and it takes a while. You know, you can stare at a tree for 15, 20 minutes to make sure you've got all the lichens that might be on it.
So you know all these walkers giving you a wide berth.
Well, you don't know how to say hello or sort of hide. You know, it's that sort of thing. And usually one or two people are brave enough and they'll come and say, what are you doing? And you just pass on this little message that you're actually trying to record. But, I mean, it's taken a long time. You know, I've spent a lot of time going through the woods. I mean, this wood alone, you know, I was in here for 3 weeks when people were fencing nearby and they kept looking at me, and eventually I went to see them and said, this is what we're doing.
It's OK, I'm all right.
Yes, yeah, but particularly when you get this mix, because the hazels here in amongst the aspens, they've got some really unusual things growing on them as well. So you've got, you know, the birch trees, if you went further west, the birch trees will be holding some of the rare stuff that we see here. I mean, we walk a little bit further on, you see one of the things you see in the west quite commonly, but it's here in small quantities, but relying on the aspen.
Stuart Taylor, winner of the RSPB Species Champion Award at the Nature of Scotland Awards last December. What was that phrase again? Panic flowering?
Yeah, you can see that quite a lot. If a plant thinks it's going to die, or say, you know, say something like a rowan facing a really hard winter, well, they get an urge to produce berries or seeds or flowers to ensure their survival.
Okay.
It's a bit like pruning to a certain extent to ensure that the plant, you stress the plant and it'll produce more fruit.
Okay. Anyway, while we're sticking with plants, and let's face it, it is pretty herbivorous, this programme. This year, the Royal Botanic Gardens in Edinburgh are celebrating the 350th anniversary, which is extraordinary. They were founded in 1670, and since then the gardens have been discovering, collecting and caring for plants. They've currently got a collection of about 13,500 living plant species. Earlier this week, they announced plans to mark this very significant birthday, and I headed along to find out more.
I am Simon Milne. I'm the 16th Regis Keeper of the Royal Botanic Garden, Edinburgh. What is the Royal Botanic Garden Edinburgh? It's an international and national institute for botanical research, for education, for inspiring the next generation of scientists, educators, horticulturists. It's a place of beauty. It's a place of immense historical wealth, and never before has there been such a greater need for botanic gardens around the world. And very proud to say that here in Edinburgh, we are in the vanguard. We are one of the leading botanic gardens in the world. Why is it so important? Well, it's addressing those fundamental challenges to society at the moment of climate change and the biodiversity crisis. One-fifth of the world's plants are threatened with extinction, and it's those plants that society relies upon for drugs, for oxygen underpinning our economy, for food, for shelter. So we have hope, because we've got the expertise here, working with our collaborators in 35 countries around the world. But this is an emergency as far as biodiversity is concerned, and I'm very proud that we are at the forefront of leading that, if you like, in terms of plant research and conservation education. But you know what? It is a wonderful, wonderful place, and it's also about inspiring people, health and well-being. Over a million visits to our four gardens around Scotland every year. So we want people to enjoy it as well as to be inspired by it.
One of the things that really surprised me, and Professor Peter Hollingsworth, the Director of Science here, is the fact that last year this place named 62 new species. I mean, you wouldn't think there was that many left out there.
That's right. When we talk about discovering life on other planets, I think sometimes we forget how little we know about life on Earth and the species on this planet that are threatened with imminent extinction.
There's an assumption that this place is full of gardeners, which it is, but it's also full of scientists. Lots and lots of scientists. Doing what?
So we've a team here of about 100 scientists working in over 35 countries around the world, and they're focusing on three main challenges: understanding the world's biodiversity, getting to grips with the threats that that biodiversity is facing, and then using this information to develop strategies to conserve and sustainably use that biodiversity.
Some of that is done as laboratory, some of it's done very much still as fieldwork, and there's a long history here of that. Mark, introduce yourself. Tell me where you're going this year.
Right, so I'm Mark Hughes, one of the scientists in the tropical diversity section here at the Garden. So we're planning an expedition to Papua New Guinea. We're doing it for two reasons, really. One of which is it fulfills our discovery science remit. Papua New Guinea is one of the most diverse islands on the planet. It's got 0.5% of global land area, but up to 10% of species. I mean, it's absolutely mind-bogglingly diverse. But in some groups of plants, only 25% of them have names. So these things need to be named. They need to have a voice for the future. They cannot be ignored. And it's also, what I find really inspiring about it is it's a good news story. Papua New Guinea has some of the most pristine forests that are left. And it's a great opportunity for us to go in there, work with our colleagues in there, in Papua New Guinea, in Lae Botanic Garden, and help and work with them to describe the amazing diversity that's on their doorstep.
You've obviously done stuff like this before. What are living conditions like when you're actually working in the field?
It varies.
he said.
it can be, we're prepared, so because you have to work hard, so you have to be comfortable, you have to try and get a good night's sleep. But we will be jungle camping, so this trip's going to be a 50-kilometre hike across the main range, going up from sea level to 3,000 metres altitude. So we'll take our own hammocks, we'll be setting up a big communal working tent in the middle, so you have to have somewhere that's dry to work, to prepare specimens and to eat, importantly, as well. So living conditions will be, I hope, tolerable, and we intend to make it back in one piece.
One of the questions that was asked upstairs was, obviously, with events in Australia at the moment, I mean, the terrible damage that's being done to not just wildlife, but to plant life across there too. Is there anything that the RBGE can actually do to help?
Yeah, RBG is part of a global network of botanic gardens, and this global network are of critical importance in dealing with these major catastrophes because they collectively have the expertise to cultivate material in different parts around the world, in different botanic gardens, get material into seed bank to save it from imminent extinction. And it's a great strength of the world botanic garden community, this working together as a global network to tackle these globally significant problems.
So this institution is interested in science. It's got 3 million dried specimens stored here. It's got a massive library. It's growing, it's developing. This is the 350th anniversary. One of the things I really admire about it is that you're not just looking at the plants, you're not just looking at the experience of coming into the garden, you are promoting the arts at the same time, which, given this had its genesis really in the Scottish Enlightenment, is the right thing to do.
Absolutely. I mean, that link between arts and science is hugely strong in so many ways. But it also helps us to put over our mission, put over the world of plants in a very different way and to reach different audiences of all backgrounds, all ages. And whether that's one of our great art exhibitions in Inverleith House, an exhibition in John Hope Gateway, or one of our regional gardens through its concerts, through children's arts, it's another way of really inspiring people with the world of nature, with the world of plants. And it's fun and it's enjoyable, and we want things to be enjoyable as well as educational.
Simon Milner, 16th Regis Keeper of the Royal Botanic Garden, Edinburgh, along with Professor Pete Hollingsworth, Director of Science, and Dr. Mark Hughes, who will be shortly heading off to Papua New Guinea. I said to Simon, you know, Regis Keeper sounds like it's a royal appointment. He says it is.
Yeah.
He says it's basically, it's got to be signed off by the First Minister of Scotland and the Queen.
It's a great title.
That's a cracking title.
And we should really go with them on some of these plant hunting trips, because the guys at Edinburgh are the best in the world. It'd be really good to go and document what they do. We keep on telling you, we love hearing where you listen to the Scotland Outdoors podcast. And that's exactly what Kate Williams did.
She said, I'm listening to Beside the Fire on a remote property in the Klondike River near Dawson City, Yukon, Canada. I first heard you on the radio while visiting my parents back in Scotland, and try and catch up with your show every week in the winter at least.
I really appreciate the work you do. I feel like I have a link back home through you, and it's great to hear about all the different projects going on in Scotland. Sometimes it makes me want to fly back and get involved. Well, that's what you should, get on a plane.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, more the merrier.
You don't want to be flying today.
No, don't be flying today. You're coming in sideways.
Now, Big Wildlife Conservation projects tend only to work if all the stakeholders involved fully embrace them, and they often rely on good local knowledge and enthusiasm. Now, the Cairngorm Capper Cayley project has been set up to do both of these things to ultimately help secure the future of this absolutely amazing bird. I met up with project manager Carolyn Robertson to find out more.
The Cairngorms Capper Cayley project, it's based here in the Cairngorms National Park, and it's all about trying to work with more people to help save Capper Cayley from extinction.
But now that's an easy thing to say.
Yeah, sure. So it's about working with the people who live, who work, who play in the park, who essentially share their space with Capercaillie. And it's about working with those people to identify potentially new ways to help save Capercaillie from extinction, as well as increase the existing solutions that we know are helpful.
What are you doing?
From a habitat point of view, we are working with land managers across the park, but quite a lot of work in the Strath Bay area to improve habitat for Capercaillie and increase habitat. So that's, at the moment, it's looking about 8,000 hectares of land in the park will be improved for Capercaillie, which will hopefully...
That's a massive amount.
Yeah, it's a big amount, and it's complicated because the Capercaillie population in the park obviously doesn't stick to one area. We're talking kind of 25 different land holdings across the Strath Bay area and into Deeside. So it's about joining things up and working with lots of different people, coming together to try and find solutions for Capercaillie.
How much of a change does it need to make in a land management point of view? Because it's all very well to have a Capercaillie, that's really nice, but I'm trying to run an estate.
Sure, and that's one of the key challenges that we understand working with land managers and landowners, that they're trying to balance all manner of things, but equally they're very committed to Capercaillie conservation, and we don't want to lose the birds, so they're pulling together and doing what they can. But that's one of the things I think about the project, is working in a community-led way, and landowners being a community in themselves, so trying to work with them to find solutions, and there's flexibility in the project to enable that to happen. So we found some really great opportunities to hopefully help make a difference. Within the habitat work, it's probably considered to be fairly traditional, so it's about increasing the availability of food plants for Capercaillie, decreasing disturbance in some areas, particularly sensitive areas perhaps where they're lekking, etc., or raising their young. But also we've got monitoring work in there, and that does start to stray into hopefully some new and successful ways to get a better understanding of how Capercaillie are doing. The last national survey back in 2015 revealed that there were just over 1,000 birds. But the data that we have since, so the survey data that we have since, demonstrates a downward trend. So it's highly likely, the sense is at the moment, that we don't have just over 1,000 birds and we potentially have less. But it's difficult to get a handle on it because they're very secretive and they don't always come to one place at any one time. So it's difficult to really understand how many there are. But using genetic material, so we're talking feathers and potentially droppings, and analysing those, we can get a much better handle on population size, and then we can work in a much more informed fashion in terms of actions. And that's one of the things that's difficult. Obviously, you need a certain amount of data to inform effective action, and we're missing bits of data.
Is it not difficult, though? I mean, we're here on a track in a beautiful pine forest that is gorgeous, but the nature of the national park, people are coming from all over to walk, to cycle, to camp. Can Capercaillie coexist with it?
Well, I think that's the million-dollar question. And I would say they can. And I would say that they are, to a degree. But it's about looking longer term. And, OK, things might be all right at the moment. But, you know, given, as I said, the data that we have in terms of the population getting towards a really critical point, you know, there's something there in terms of viability. If they fall any lower in number, then they will sort of follow the train that Wildcat took and become functionally extinct. So that is part of what the project is trying to do, is trying to work with folk who cycle, who walk, who run in the woods, and work with them to identify some potential solutions.
Is there not a danger there that it's a lack of education? You've got people cycling along a path like this. You might not even know there's a Capercaillie 200 yards away.
Yeah. We've definitely recognised through chatting at a community level that there's lots of stuff there that people just aren't aware of, or they've become numb to. And so yes, the project is looking at ways to increase the profile of Capercaillie in a sensitive way, because obviously there's this real kind of catch-22 where you want to help folk understand a little bit more about the potential impact they're having on Capercaillie, but at the same time not cause any issues for Capercaillie by revealing too much.
What kind of response are you getting?
A good response, yeah. So, as I say, land manager, landowner level, really good response. At a community level, equally good response. So we've had conversations with, to give you a figure, like over 800 folk have come forward so far. We've turned up at events, we've held workshops, we've run public open events for anyone to come along, and people are really interested. I think Capercaillie just captures the imagination. It's a bird that's been with us since the last ice age. We desperately don't want to lose it, and people want to try and work with us and understand that it's complicated, and it gets a bit challenging to kind of plot a path through when there are so many issues affecting Capercaillie. There is not one single thing that is affecting Capercaillie and not one single action. It's a whole range of solutions that we need to try and find.
Can you save them?
I would hope so. Yeah, I think this project is a really positive step in that direction. So the work that we're developing at the moment will be delivered over 3 years. It's subject to funding from the National Lottery Heritage Fund, who've been absolutely fantastic so far and given us a development grant to come up with some ideas and solutions. And we're sharing that with them soon. And then if they like it, we'll deliver the work over 3 years. And there's no doubt that it will make a difference because it's, as I say at the beginning, it's using some of the stuff that we know works, and it's about upscaling that, but it's also finding some new innovative ways to help Capercaillie.
Cairngorms Capercaillie project manager Carolyn Robertson there. And you know, whilst I fully support the efforts, if you actually look at the history of the thing, it's been reintroduced to Scotland twice. The last reintroduction, I can't remember how many thousands of birds they put back into the wild, and 95% of those have disappeared. Is it time now just to say, look, tell you what, it's not meant to be here, it's too sensitive?
I don't know, but if you can create the right conditions.
If?
Well, you know, in the past there wasn't the research, there wasn't the financial input for changing the infrastructure. If you can get it right, it's a bird well worth having.
Yeah. Well, true, it's a magnificent animal to actually see in the wild, but it's given how sensitive it is to human disturbance and given how popular Cairngorms National Park is, are the two of them ever really going to mesh?
Yeah, that's a difficult one. Mm. Well, maybe Capercaillie isn't... Cairngorms isn't the right place for it.
Yeah.
Maybe you should places like Glen Tanner or more remote places that don't have a huge amount of people coming through.
Yeah. As ever, interested in your comments on that, you can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Now, I gave up doing New Year's resolutions donkeys years ago. It was a waste of time. I never stuck to any of them. But it may be possible that you've started off the year thinking I'm going to be healthier or cut out certain foods or try and eat more fruit and vegetables. But here's an idea. There's one berry that grows in the East Lothian coastline. Well, there's lots of this one type of berry, I should say, that you might not be aware of, but it is the perfect antioxidant to kickstart 2020. A lady called Kirsty Campbell revealed all.
So these little orange berries growing on the jaggy bushes in front of us are a sea buckthorn. And sea buckthorn is an ancient plant. It's been around since the preglacial period in Scotland. Whilst here it was planted to stabilise the sand dunes, it has actually been around in different parts of Scotland, particularly around the coast and down in England along the east coast for a very, very long time. It's an ancient food.
This is, I mean, it lives up to its name. It is a thorn. It's kind of a jaggy plant. The berries themselves, bright orange normally during the summer, but obviously they go a bit paler during the winter, sort of, you know, almost a sort of, not quite white, but nearly. The leaves have all come off this because of the frosts, but as I recall, it's a sort of, it's almost like an olive-coloured leaf.
Yes, it is. I think the name in Italian is spiny olive, in the translation. They contain a lot of oils, as do olives, so perhaps that's part of the reason why the original Latin name means shining horse, although, and also perhaps thanks to all of the oils, when the Greeks would send out their horses after battle, they'd come back with these shining coats and shining eyes as well from all the vitamins and minerals. They've got omega 3, 6, 7, and 9 in them, of all things.
Did you say they've been in this country since the last ice age? Because I thought they'd been introduced.
Well, they have certainly been introduced here in Gullen. Uh-huh. But there's an area just south of Berwick-upon-Tweed where the EU monitors to make sure that that's been continuously there. And that's where it's been certainly considered to be native. There have been various studies that have been done with sort of carbon deposits, and it has proven to be indeed, indeed native.
I don't know whether there's a track down here. I'm kind of hoping that there is, because we just need to get slightly out of this wind. We're kind of playing catch-up here, because you are actually using the berries here.
Yes, so I have a permit from the council who need to cut it back every year. Uh-huh. So I'm helping them to trim back the bushes in order to then make as many different things from it as I can. I've started off making a sea buckthorn juice, which I'll have to give you some to try.
Yeah, and, I'm up for that.
Two different varieties. There's the buckshot, which is the straight, the straight, very sour juice. Uh-huh. And something I call the buck Russian, because it's... It's developed on a Russian hangover cure. And we've also been working with the Scottish Rural Colleges to develop fermented drinks as well. So we've made, this year we've made a sea buckthorn ginger beer and a sea buckthorn water kefir, which we're hoping to launch next year.
Can you actually eat the berries straight off the bush?
You can. Now, at this point, they'll smell a little bit fermented because they've been sitting on the bush now for quite a long time, and the taste will have changed a bit.
Better to go for the bright orange ones or the white ones? Which?
I'd go for the more orange ones, but it's for the experience of it. They will squash in your fingers, you'll find, at this point.
Oh, they do, yeah.
But if you smell it now, it's very strong, pungent smell. Which,
that's extraordinary, because it does smell like fermented fruit. I really like that, because it's salty as well.
It has a salty, sour flavour. I don't know whether you can feel on your hand where you've squeezed the...
I can't feel my hands at all.
Well, it's at this point, the oils have increased in the berries, whereas before, earlier in the season, they were higher in vitamin C, A and E. At this point, the oils are increasing, so if you rub it on your hands, it's almost like a moisturiser. And it's very good for your skin, although, as I say, it's got quite a... luckily, the wind is blowing away the stronger fermented smell you have here.
Let's get around the other side of the bush and out of the wind if we can. The thing about sea buckthorn is, it is absolutely festooned with berries, but it is so attractive to birds. There was a huge flock of fieldfares just rose off this earlier.
Really? That's great to know, because the fieldfares are one of the reasons the council here are keen to keep this here. Ah. It's a great source of winter food for migrating birds. Yeah. Hence, we want to leave plenty on there, taking a bit off from the juice, but we've hopefully left, as you see, plenty there for the birds to be able to still munch on.
How do you actually harvest them? Because, we've just tried it. They're really difficult to pick.
They are really difficult to pick. That's why I've got a special permit from the council where I'm trimming the bushes back. Uh-huh. So I'm trimming back the bushes and putting them into big freezers. Uh-huh. And then I then have a great entertaining time of trying to knock them off in the freezer without getting them all over the place.
So getting completely covered in the things.
Here we go. Oh, so I have here a little morning shot of the Buck Russian.
Okay.
And we have a wee glass here.
You've got
for
a shot glass,
try.
Right? Okay.
So this is a much earlier harvest. Uh-huh. So the smell should be different.
Okay.
Then let's see what you make.
It's like carrot juice. It's that orange.
You can see the beta carotene in it for sure.
Yeah, it smells nice actually.
Yeah.
Well, that's lovely.
So that's been slightly sweeter.
That is really nice. What have you done with that?
So that's the Moors, the Russian version. So I've made the cold pressed juice, and then I've got the seeds and the pulp, and I've infused them with some ginger.
Yeah.
Let them sit there for a couple of hours, and then added a little bit of sugar to that, a bit of demerara, a bit of beet sugar, and then added the two together, the juice and the infusion, in order to make a combined drink that's quite a good little breakfast shot.
That is a very, very good way to start your day, that.
It certainly is, especially if you've had a beer too many the night before.
People talk about businesses and scalability. Is it just you working on this?
At the moment, it's just me doing most of the foraging. I had help from another aid worker came to help me this year. But we are a community interest company, and we've got two other directors. We're looking at making the most of all of the sea buckthorn. So not just we're making the juice from the berries, but then we're also doing some tests with Bangor University to look at extracting the seeds and the pulp for the oils, and also the leaves, because the leaves contain leaf lipids, which can be used in the cosmetics industry. So rather than to go too large in terms of all of the berries in Scotland, we're looking at really making the most of those that we are harvesting and seeing what we can do with them to maximise their potential.
I have known of these things for years. It seems strange that no one's actually thought to turn it into a business, to turn it into a crop.
There are a couple of farmers down south, actually. Seth Pascoe, down at Cornish Seaberry Company, and David Eagle at the British Sea Buckthorn Company, who have been growing now. I think David's been growing for about 10 years, and Seth started a little bit after him, after discovering it in Everest, where he was given sea buckthorn from a Sherpa after he was suffering from altitude sickness. It's the strangest thing. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I heard of it when I was in Pakistan working for the World Food Programme, where the people in the north rely on sea buckthorn as a source of winter food to survive. And I came back here and wasn't quite sure what to do after a career in humanitarian aid, a bit burnt out, didn't really feel like an office job. And I was foraging around and discovered how many berries there are here and the fact that they are, you know, they are cut back every year and normally burnt. It would seem like an automatic thing. And when I started to research, I couldn't believe it. In fact, this berry was the first fruit to go to space with the Russian cosmonauts.
Seriously?
Yes, and gram for gram, of course, anything that goes to space is worth the same as gold. So they certainly treasure it. And they have military programs developing all sorts of less thorny varieties and so on. But, you know, the Canadians are growing it as well. The Chinese have planted huge amounts because it's incredibly good for the soil. It's a nitrogen-fixing plant, so you can plant sea buckthorn in soils that are otherwise very much deteriorated, and as well as holding the sand together as they do here. They're also very good for anti-pollution because they absorb a lot of the pollutants from the air.
And it's kind of a miracle plant.
It is indeed, or the holy plant or the miracle berry, as the conferences call it.
And I really like the taste of those, cheers.
Kirsty Campbell there from Sea Buckthorn Scotland. Have you ever tasted it?
No, but I will, because I want my coat to look really glossy.
It is. It's an extraordinarily complex, I would say, grown-up adult taste. And I think it's only going to be a matter of time before Kirsty gets together with either somebody that's producing small amounts of local vodka or gin or something of the kind and produces an alcoholic variant of that. Because, you know, it's got success written all over it.
If there's enough berries.
Yeah, well, there are. There are. You put up a photo on the Out of Doors Facebook page earlier this week. And I mean, I could see it was of a stone, but I must admit, I kind of flicked past it without actually figuring out what it was about.
It's a wee stone with a sheep's horn on it.
Aye.
And some
carved.
Strange words. Yeah, carved. I was in Cumbria over Christmas, and when we were out for a walk up on the hills, I spotted these strange stones, and I dug into it, and they've got a really fascinating history.
Old Molly Metcalf counting sheep.
It's a really blustery day, and I'm walking along a small bit of the Ullswater Way, just a few miles over the border into England, and it is truly spectacular. Below me, way below me, stretches Ullswater, today looking dark and mysterious, home, it's said, to massive monsters up to 200 feet long, and the rather odd survivor of the Ice Age, the Shelly, originally a herring-like fish which became trapped by the ice and slowly evolved to survive in the fresh water of the lake. But it's not fish and it's not monsters that I'm trying to track down. This is sheep country. The rolling hills and mountains are perfect habitat for the very distinctive Herdwick sheep. The chunky, stocky animals with a very distinctive charcoal-grey fleece, a white head and strong, powerful legs, originally thought to have been brought by the Vikings. Indeed, the name Herdwick is thought to have originated from the Old Norse Herdvik, meaning sheep pasture. Now, whether the Vikings brought them or not, they are perfect for this rugged landscape. They're known to have survived under snow for days, and they survive by eating their own wool. But it was Beatrix Potter that brought the breed's attention to a wider audience. She kept and bred Herdwicks, and on her death in 1943, she bequeathed 15 farms to the National Trust of England, who continue to graze them to this very day. In fact, I'm looking around me just now towards the lake, and I can see large numbers of them grazing amongst the bracken. And it's these sheep that are at the heart of a strange occupation that stretches back probably as long as these sheep have been in the lakes. In front of me is a strange stone with a ram's horn carved in relief with the words Tyne written above it. Now, I've just passed a similar stone set into the dike about 200 yards back the track, and it was marked Terthera. And there's another one further up the mountain called Yan. It's all very odd. They're known, apparently, as the Herdwick stones, carved by sculptor Charlotte Roos and placed on the trail in celebration of an ancient way of counting sheep.
Grow, little sheep, come wind, come rain, yah!
Counting sheep is what shepherds do the world over. In places like Australia, it's now a national sport. In other areas, the shepherd will make an educated guess. But what a shepherd really wants in life is an accurate count in case one of them is missing.
On the back in the bracken with frozen bones, John Tantalamillipipshecounted.
And it's here, it's thought, this unique way of counting sheep evolved. For in the pocket of each shepherd were 10 stones. Each stone represents 20 sheep. And so the sheep were counted. Yan, a bit like our one. Tyan, number two. Tethera, number three. And so, Methera, Pimp, Sethera, Lethera, Hovera, Dovera, Dick for 10, and then Yanadick, Tyanadick, Tetheradick, Metheradick, Bumfit, Yanabumfit, Tianabumfit, Tetherabumfit, Metherabumfit, and finally, Gigot, 20. And at 20, or Gigot, a pebble was transferred to the other pocket, and the count restarted. 10 stones equals 200 sheep. Job done. And variations of Yan, Tan, Tethera exist throughout England and Wales and southern Scotland. It was also used in counting stitches, and there's even a Scottish country dance, Yan, Tan, Tethera. And all of that from a walk in the hills.
Yan, Tan, Tan, the mother pip, she said.
Tan, Tan, the mother pip, she said.
Where is that language from?
I'm guessing it's Anglo-Saxon, there's variations, but you can get... I was astounded when you look into it. There's variations on that 1 to 20, from Brittany to Cornwall to Wales, southern Scotland, all very, very similar. Mm-hmm. And just fascinating, strange words.
Very strange words, yeah.
They always sound rude in places.
there are one or two that verge ever so slightly on it. Anyway, that's all we've got time for this week's podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us again next week when we've probably got more of the same. If we're spared by the winds, we're not blown off the face of the planet. From all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks very much for listening.